On the program today, a little real estate, a little fashion, and man, have you tried parking in New York City lately? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 28th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This is one of those days of which there have been so many lately. I know that the news cycle has gone into overdrive. And look, we get that. But that said, the economy does kind of have cycles of its own, you know, and our coverage of it begins today with something called the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Index. Yes, home prices, about which there is some good news. The meteoric increases we've been seeing in those prices is slowing down. A bit. A very little bit. Up 20.4% nationally. That's for April compared with the same month a year ago. The March annual increase, 20.6%. So, a very little bit, just like I said. But, you know, progress, right? And in a change from the past 5 months, when most of the 20 cities in that index saw month-over-month increases, only 9 cities did this time. Now, price behavior like we've been seeing in housing lately makes people do some interesting things. And as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, people are flipping houses at the highest rate they've been doing that since at least the year 2000.
Given how hot the housing market is, if you were looking for a fixer-upper last year, chances are you were competing with some flippers. Rick Sharga is with Adam Data Solutions.
Flipping tends to go up during periods of time where there's really high demand for households, and prices are going up as well.
Sharga says 10% of houses sold in the first quarter of this year were flipped. In Phoenix, which is among the cities where home prices have increased most, that number was almost 20%. Now, this data doesn't necessarily tell us where the market is going. It tells us more about where it's been.
Properties we see flipped in the next couple of quarters are homes that were purchased 3, 6, 9 months ago.
The lag between buying and selling means we don't know how many of today's buyers plan to flip. But Sharga expects to see less of it because it's less profitable. Margins are at their slimmest in more than a decade because rising interest rates affect how much buyers are willing to spend. Plus, there's the rising cost of getting all the work done. Danielle Hale is an economist at Realtor.com.
Investors likely saw higher prices for the materials that they were using to try to improve the house, and probably also for the labor costs.
Fewer flippers could mean more inventory for people looking for starter homes, says Daniel McMillan, who chairs the real estate department at the University of Illinois Chicago. But
first-time home buyers are typically affected much more by higher interest rates.
Today, the average rate for a 30-year fixed mortgage is 5.9%, almost twice what it was 6 months ago. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street on this Tuesday, oh look, today was an everything is terrible day. Go figure. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The G7, that is the group of seven formerly, the world's seven biggest advanced economies, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the UK, and us as well, if you'd forgotten, wrapped up a three-day summit in the Bavarian Alps today. Top of mind for the presidents and their finance ministers was how to starve Russia for cash when the world still needs Russian oil and gas. Well, President Biden thinks he has a solution. Cap the prices for Russian oil. And in its official post-summit communique, the G7 said it would evaluate the feasibility and efficiency of the price cap idea. So we asked Marketplace's Matt Levin this morning. We said, hey, Matt, evaluate the feasibility and efficiency of price cap ideas, would you?
What we're really talking about here is kind of a bizarro version of OPEC. Instead of a cartel of oil sellers that gang up to keep profits high, it would be a cartel of oil buyers that gang up to tell Vladimir Putin,
we'll buy your oil, but only at this price. And because there's enough of us that we have market power, you have no choice but to go along with it.
Mark Finley researches energy markets at Rice University. Russian oil is selling around $80 a barrel. If the G7 and EU say, we're doing $40 a barrel, take it or leave it.
Asserting that price cap would then give Russia's other customers, like China and India, the leverage to say, well, if that's what they're paying, that's all we're going to pay you.
But China and India aren't keen to punish Putin and are already getting discounts on the tons of Russian oil they're buying. Ellen Wald at Transversal Consulting says risking the wrath of Russia probably isn't worth it.
India is totally reliant on oil imports. They produce no oil of their own, and China just has massive needs.
The U.S. could announce sanctions for anyone anywhere who pays above a price cap, but Charles Litchfield at the Atlantic Council says that would be geopolitically costly and difficult to enforce.
It opens the door, I think, to a new front for sanctions evasion, a new front for corruption. It will just be too tempting.
He says it would also be a mistake to underestimate Russia's capacity to retaliate, maybe by completely shutting off natural gas to Europe as winter nears.
Russia can flex its muscles because it's taken in so much money already this year.
Litchfield says Russia has already received more revenue from oil and gas than it expected for all of 2022. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
With inflation and the general state of this economy temporarily out of the headlines, we thought today would be a good day to resume our regular round of talking to our regulars to see what's what with them, which is why we dialed up Logan, Ohio this morning to talk to Dr. Scott Anzalone, an independent that is running his own business, family physician that we catch up with from time to time.
You know, my employees, they're having a hard time with gas prices, getting to work. I gave him a raise, but it's eaten away. Yeah. You know, to try to help. I bought him a gas card a couple of weeks ago just to say thank you and help him out. But it hits my bottom line. And, you know, increasing salary keeps going up and my in healthcare, at least reimbursement keeps going down. Cost of everything goes up and, the money only goes so far.
Yeah. Do you worry about your staff just saying, you know what, Scott, I love you, but I got to go work somewhere else where I can make a decent money?
Oh, it's happened repetitively. I've lost good staff because neighboring hospitals or other systems, they basically, you know, they throw golden carrots out and I can't compete being in private practice. Yeah. And, you can't blame them. They come to me and tell me what they're going to pay them. And I'm like, wow, well, take me with you, you know, but yeah, it's tough. And I feel for them. I watch them struggle.
Yeah. One of the other reasons we wanted to talk to you, as often happens when we think about getting you on the phone, is that you are, now you're the past president, but the immediate past president of the Logan Hocking Board of Education for the school district there. And I wanted to ask you about, obviously, the news from Uvalde and a guy whose civic contribution it is to help run and keep a local school district safe. How do you, first of all, think about that day in and day out?
Every day, our goal is to educate our students. And when we were in school, I'm sure we're not too far off age-wise. Yeah. We didn't have to worry about those things. You know, you went to school, you listened, you learned, and you didn't have to worry about things like this. And our kids, they come every day in a state of trauma. In our district, we were very proactive. Back in 2017, 18, we were already looking at this. We have resource officers in every single one of our buildings. We have our county sheriff's department, our local police department, all working together as a team with our schools. We have our own drug dog, and we have secured all of our buildings throughout the county. There's one way in, one way out when our students are there, and we've done everything possible to make sure security is tight without making kids more traumatized.
The catch, of course, with all this stuff is that it's expensive, and Logan Hocking is not a wealthy school district.
No, and back when we started this, we started with one resource officer, and at the time that was the discussion: how are we going to pay for this? And it wasn't an option. After the Parkland shooting, our community, we had a community-wide meeting. It's parents, everyone was there, stakeholders, and they're like, you know what, we will do whatever it takes to keep our kids safe. Mm. We were able to pull up funds of our own between us and the Sheriff's Department, Police Department, to fund one resource officer that year. And then since then, we have just, it's just part of our budget. And it, our community is helping pay for it. The Sheriff's Department is helping to cover some of the costs of their employees. It wasn't an option. It's like, we have to do this.
Yeah, but you're going to have to be doing this. We're all going to have to be doing this for a long time. And you know, states and cities have gotten some help from the federal government during the pandemic. And I imagine balance sheets look okay now. But talk to me about the out years, right? Because you got to keep on going with this.
One of the things we've looked at is, you know, what can we do to prevent, you know, future problems? You know, one of the issues on our end was mental health. And we're hoping with this new legislation that just got passed that we'll be open and available some federal funds to help buy more stuff for the buildings, but also to help cover the mental health costs that we've already instituted in our buildings. But the big issue is, you know, a lot of these funds are one-time monies. Yeah. And we do our best to have, you know, our treasurer provides us, you know, a five-year forecast, and we try to look at everything that's coming down the road and be as prepared as we can.
Dr. Scott Anzalone, Stagecoach Family Medicine is his practice in Logan, Ohio. He's also the past president of the Board of Education for Logan-Hocking School District. Scott, thanks a lot for your time and always for your insights on life out there.
Always fun talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, as the more detail-oriented listeners to this program might be aware, is based in Portland, Oregon, has been for years. But on his way home from vacation a week or two ago, Mitchell stopped for a couple of days in New York City, Brooklyn to be precise, and not long after he got back home, all the way home, he let loose in our morning editorial meeting one day about modern technology, money, and a motor vehicle. And as he explains to you now, it all started with a parking space.
I was looking for something elusive, a legal spot big enough to parallel park my rented Chevy Malibu. And there it was, like a miracle on DeKalb Avenue, right in front of Junior's coffee shop. I sent my son in to order and went to feed the electronic meter. Tried to put in quarters, but the slot was jammed. Tried several credit cards, it rejected every one. And each time, the machine made the helpful suggestion. You could use New York's smartphone app and pay online. So I logged in, provided a bunch of personal data, and filled my virtual parking wallet. Minimum purchase, $25 for a $2 parking spot. All that time and technology, I thought there's gotta be a better way. Like, why not just go back to the old meters that take nickels, dimes, and quarters?
We do have a few coin meters in Cleveland.
Robert Simons directs the Cleveland State University School of Urban Affairs.
Not so convenient in terms of time intensity for collection. And of course, lovely Rita Meter Maid is no longer employed.
The new kiosks and apps can be confusing, glitchy, and time consuming, but
the technology has made a lot of changes possible.
That's UCLA urban planning professor Donald Shoup, who literally wrote the book on this. It's titled The High Cost of Free Parking. He says an online payment system can adjust the cost of parking by location or time of day or size of car to reduce congestion or improve the environment.
Some cities give lower prices for cars with lower emissions.
And cities can jack up the price of parking, Robert Simons says, to discourage people from driving or even owning a car in the city.
It'll make it more annoying for people to go out and feed the meter. They'll find some other way to get to work.
It costs $20 to park in one of the private lots near Junior's. If the meter in front of the restaurant charged that much, I might take the subway next time. It turns out I can get a refund on the money left in my virtual wallet. But the whole thing left a bad taste in my mouth. And paying for parking took so long, my matzo ball soup got cold and the server had to reheat it in the microwave. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
everything that they made would fit perfectly.
In an ideal world. First, though, let's do the numbers. Oh, I don't know if I'd have gone with the Wawas, but I don't get to decide. Dow Industrial's down 491 today, 1.5%, 30,946. NASDAQ off 343 points, nearly 3%. Well, there's the Wawas trigger, right? 11,181. S&P 500 lopped off 78 points, about 2%. 38 and 21. We got Case Shiller today, as we mentioned, shows a slight slowdown in home price increases in April. So, real estate companies, how about that? Zillow marked down 2.8% today. Redfin delisted 4.4%. Delisted, get it? Matt Levin kicked tires on water and oil. Price cap might look like ExxonMobil pumped up 2.7%. Chevron gushed up 1.6%. Price cap? What price cap? Bonds rose. Yield on 10-year T-note fell to 3.18%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Arguably the story about labor in this country right now, since the pandemic started, actually, I guess, is what you might call micro-organizing. Individual retail stores or sometimes warehouses, usually of big chains or brand-name companies, starting union organizing campaigns one by one. So, a story now about how companies in general are trying to head off that organizing. A new law goes into effect in Connecticut on Friday that effectively limits what are often called captive audience meetings, mandatory informational meetings held by an employer during working hours, usually in the context of one of those aforementioned union organizing campaigns. Connecticut is set to prohibit companies from forcing workers to go to those kinds of meetings. It'll be the second state to do that after Oregon. And it comes as the White House is paying attention to the issue, too. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on that one.
These meetings can take lots of forms, says Erica Smiley, a longtime union organizer who leads Jobs with Justice.
They'll call it coaching, or it'll be just like a team building presentation.
Generally, she says, about why the company doesn't need a union.
You've got someone who's basically saying, your job is on the line. You have to come to this meeting. That's essentially a captive audience meeting.
I will say that is not the term we'd prefer to use. I think we would call them more, information sessions.
Jim Peretti is a management side attorney with Littler Mendelson.
Any employer who's facing, an organizing campaign is going to want to explain their point of view. It's our opportunity to say, hey, this is what having a union means and what it doesn't.
Federal labor law prohibits employers from making threats or coercive statements during these meetings, says labor attorney Paul Secunda, a former law professor at Marquette University. But he says the messages don't need to be explicit.
Rightfully motivated by the necessity of continued employment, employees will not miss the threatening subtext of carefully crafted messages.
Recent union drives at big corporations like Starbucks, Apple, and Amazon have brought this into the spotlight, says Ruth Milkman, a labor sociologist at CUNY.
So because these are brand names that every American and people outside the U.S. for that matter are familiar with, it's all become extremely visible.
The Connecticut law is likely to face legal challenges, as other state laws have, because it sets up a potential conflict with federal law. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Unless you are real tuned into the fashion world and the business thereof, you might have missed it last month when Old Navy basically gave up on its in-store plus-sized collection. Body Quality, it was called, Old Navy's play to capitalize on size inclusivity, which, according to the market research firm Credence Research, will globally be a $260 billion industry in the next 5 years. Lucrative, perhaps, but not easy at all for reasons that Elizabeth Segrin pointed out in Fast Company the other day. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
What went wrong with Old Navy and Body Quality?
Oh, my goodness. Well, to start with, last August, Old Navy said that it was unveiling what it described as its biggest launch in the entire history of the brand. And basically what it said was that it was going to make every single style of clothing in its line from size 0 to size 30. Most fashion brands specialize in making clothes that only go up to size 16. Hmm. And there are some brands that go into the plus size, which only specialize in making clothes 18 and up. So it was a really big deal because until now, you know, if you went shopping with a friend of yours and you were a size 8 and your friend was a size 18, you couldn't actually shop in the same stores. Yeah. And for a long time, plus size women have said that they felt really marginalized by the entire fashion industry.
So if Old Navy had picked a sweet spot, as it were, and I'll get to this with some other companies in a minute, but if they had said, let's start in the mid-range of all women instead of everybody 0 to 30, that might have worked, right?
Yes. So the problem was that they couldn't tell which sizes to put in which stores. When you went into an Old Navy store, there were tons of clothes in the middle sizes that were gone because everybody mm-hmm. had bought them. And basically, there was a lot of inventory that was too small or too large.
So can we talk about women in this economy and what they shop for size-wise when they go into a store? I'm sure somebody knows, and it's probably you, actually, in this conversation, what the median woman is in this economy and how you engineer size distribution when you're a buyer and you're trying to figure out what to do.
So what's really interesting is that the average woman in the United States is a size 18. Okay. And plus size women make up more than half the market. And yet plus size clothes only make up 19% of all apparel on the market. The fashion brands are not actually meeting the needs of their customer.
It seems just wild because companies are leaving money on the table. The business opportunity in the plus sizes would seem to be sizable.
It's a huge wasted opportunity. And part of the problem is that it takes a lot of skill to be able to make a garment that fits really well in a size 0 as well as a size 30. Hmm. And so brands really haven't taken the time to invest in this kind of technology. But Old Navy did.
Oh, wait, say more about that.
So Old Navy spent 2 years developing all of this really cool design technology so that everything that they made would fit perfectly, no matter what size you were. And they also re-engineered their stores so that women could shop based on the style of the garment rather than having to go to a special plus size section if they wanted to buy a particular piece of clothing. And this was a really important thing for them to do to push the industry forward when it comes to size inclusivity, because most brands are not doing this.
Okay, so look, Old Navy has tried this. It didn't work spectacularly. In point of fact, it cost the president and CEO of the Old Navy line her job. It hit Gap really, really hard. Now what happens with this, what could be a really profitable segment of the plus women's market if Old Navy's out?
So Old Navy has said that it's scaling back the program a little bit. But I think what's really important for Old Navy is that it actually takes the time to figure out, all of this back end data that it needs so that it can make these smarter decisions. If they can figure out some of these technical issues, then they're going to be far, far more successful. It's just about growing pains.
Elizabeth Segrin is a senior staff writer at Fast Company, writing recently about the challenges of Old Navy and its plus-size program. Elizabeth, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your expertise.
Thank you so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today. I saw this in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend. You know how inflation and interest rates are everything right now in the world of what is going to happen with this economy, consumers and prices and all of that? Well, the Journal points out that it's not just regular people paying more as rates go up. You know, so is the Treasury Department. Net interest costs on government debt since the beginning of this fiscal year, which started last October, up 30% from the same period a year earlier. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. A word to the wise, perhaps, for new car buyers. You've heard of J.D. Power, right, and their various surveys and announcements and all of that. Here is one about cars. I saw this in Axios, to give the credit where it's due. The number of problems with new cars is the highest it's been in the 36 years that J.D. Power has been doing its initial quality study. Why is it so high? Well, stop me if you've heard this before. Supply chain issues and staffing, J.D. Power says. So there you go. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.